If you can hear this message, listen closely. To the exiled, misunderstood, or upside down, this is your message of hope. When problems come, use them. When enemies persecute you, love them. These struggles are a fire, refining you into gold. Look around. You are not forgotten. You are not alone. Challenge what is expected of you. This world is not your home. You are different.
My name is Dan. It is my pleasure, my joy to serve as pastor here and provide the main messaging every Sunday. I recently came across the list of the companies in our country who have the greatest reputation, who are most well-liked and well-respected companies. In fact, they're not the companies that are in our nation, but in our country, the ones that have the highest reputation. And there are three of them that I wanted to mention to you today. These are the highest-ranked reputation of all the companies. You think of how many companies there are. There's limitless numbers of companies, and three of them have the highest ranked reputation among those of us who are here in our country. Number three is the Walt Disney Company. What are they known for? Their entertainment, right? Their theme park and their feature films, of course, now. Then number two is Lego. Let's hear it for Lego. Aren't you happy for Lego? Building blocks, children's toy, and that's what they're known for. And known for making grown men cry all over the world on Christmas morning, trying to put some of these things together. When I find myself at a dead end with any kind of Lego set or chemistry set or whatever, do you know what I do with it? Even technology, I just hand it to my 11-year-old, and then bam, it's all fixed up. Number one country, I got to warn you, it's going to be a little bit of a letdown, okay? So the number one company with the highest ranked reputation is Rolex, known for luxury watches. Everybody hold up their luxury watch. No, not really. So there is another group that I wanted to kind of put out there for you. And I want you to try to think real quick where this group ranks in terms of this group's reputation, and it is the Christian church. Where does the Christian church rank? When you think about the reputation of the Christian church, even here in America, what are we known for? What is the church known for? High moral standards? Our politics? Our TV preachers? Our celebrity pastors? What are we known for? Are we known for our compassion, our charity, our soup kitchens? Are we known for unfortunately, some of the headlines might actually be true that we're more known now for corrupt clergy than anything else? It's also possible that we have a reputation for being kind to people. I read an article last night that said that Christians are very well known in the restaurant industry of being cheap tippers. Did you know that? There's stories of, I read a story about servers in restaurants trying to desperately switch out of Sunday afternoons to get away from the big church people who overwork them and undertip them. The article went on to explain that the truth is that most groups of people are known for skimpy tips and high demand, not just Christians, but certainly a reputation I've heard of being in the restaurant industry very early on in my adult life. But it's possible, too, that we think of Christians, we think of people who are known for their politeness, their kindness, their smiles. And I wanted to say that I think it's possible, if you really get the scripture text and you absorb what it is that we're supposed to be about, we can't settle for just being nice people, kind people, good tippers, high morals, politically engaged, kind to our coworkers. There's more. There is so much more to make believers. Listen, if you think Christians are the ones smiling at you and holding the door open when you're, I would like to argue that that's probably could very well just be a decent human being doing the minimum of kindness. Believers who belong to God, according to the scriptures, actually demonstrate so much more that makes them different from anybody else. So much more that makes them different from anybody else. Let's read it together. We'll be in 1 Peter chapter 1 today. 1 Peter chapter 1, let's read that together. We're going to start with verse 2, and then we'll do two verses, 21 and 22. Verse 2, God the Father knew you and chose you long ago, and His Spirit has made you holy. As a result, you have obeyed Him and have been cleansed by the blood of Jesus Christ. May God give you more and more grace and peace. Let's skip down to verse 21. Through Christ, you have come to trust in God, and you have placed your faith and hope in God because He raised Christ from the dead and He gave Him great glory. You were cleansed from your sins when you obeyed the truth. So now, you must show sincere love to each other as brothers and sisters. Love each other deeply with all your heart. A couple of weeks ago, we said that when you belong to God as a child of God, you're different because of the way in which you face suffering, which is with hope. Believing that this isn't all there is, that there is a life to come where God rewards. And also, we said last week that if you belong to God, you're a child of God, then you are different in the way that you live in a hostile world, and that is that you live a holy life in a hostile world. And this week, we're going to talk about what's different about believers with this big idea, that as God's child, you are different because of the way you treat each other. Because of the way you treat each other. That's what determines and defines and indicates that you and I belong to God as a child of God, and that is that we treat each other different than people who don't belong to God. You know, I find that in this season of Thanksgiving, I can't stop thinking about how grateful, thankful I am to have the role and responsibility given by God to lead, love, and pastor this church family. I thank God for you. I pray for you. I am so strengthened, encouraged, built up, and rewarded by you. It's a joy to do that. When I think about the thing that kind of is kind of in the back of my mind every Sunday when we all leave being together on a Sunday morning, I often think this. I hope and I pray, God, may it be true that everyone here saw and sensed that they were treated differently here than they were in the rest of the week. That they were treated differently here than they were at work, potentially at home, potentially by extended family, by their neighbors, by their boss. God, may it be true that what people experienced here among the North Central Church family helps them to see and sense that's a different place. Those people are different. And not different by some of the surface reasons, not different by our methodology, not different by our techniques, not different because we sing louder, we give more, we sign up to serve, we take notes during the message, we bring our Bibles, which is all true, right? Not different by things that are surface, not different by our technique and our approach, but different by the way that we engage and treat and conduct ourselves towards one another. That's what I pray. God, may you help us accurately represent who you are to one another when we're together. Here's what I learned in 1 Peter, that if we love Jesus, we love His church family. If we have a genuine, authentic, vibrant love for Jesus, we also love Jesus's family. We love His Father, and we love His younger, according to the Scriptures, siblings, Jesus being the elder brother, that we would, in fact, have affection not just for Jesus, but for those whom He loves. And Peter has this theme that's running throughout all of these chapters in 1 Peter, especially in 1 Peter chapter 1, that true believers are set apart from the hostile world in which they live. By the way, set apart meaning not absent from the world, but separate, set apart, distinct among the world, with a different attitude, different values, and different conduct. And if you're a believer here today, something happened to you. What exactly happened that made you or that transformed you as a believer from a citizen of the world to a child of God? What exactly happened to you? I have it in your notes here. We'll see this in verse 2, verse 21, and verse 22, that God saved you with a different kind of love in order to set you apart for a different kind of life. There is purposeful reasons by which God used a different love to save you and then set you apart to live a different life. You are not designed, and you were not reborn to live the same life with just a little bit of religious juice on Sundays. You are saved with a special kind of love, a different kind of love, in order to live a different kind of life. You were cleansed, according to the scriptures, so now, you were cleansed, so now, you were cleansed, so now. They are connected together. God did something, and then he says, now you go and do something. You go live and express this in a unique and different way. And Christians have been remade by their maker to reflect the maker. Let me put it this way. The life of God has been deposited in your spirit. The life of God, meaning the love of God, has been deposited in your spirit. And God has done that as he makes us new again. A life given over to the genuine care of others is a natural result of being born again. When you are born again, there is a natural affection, a newness, a genuine care for other people. When you get a fresh start on life, love should happen. The logic of love rests in this. God is life, and God is love. And if that's the case, then if God sent his word into your hearts to give you life, then you have tasted of his fullness, and you then make manifest the fruit of his character. It is the outflow of our hearts to reflect the life of God in us, which of course is his love. God's nature is love. His essence is love. In fact, get it. Imagine this. You are so thoroughly loved by God, there's no need to take or manipulate the love of someone else for yourself. Let me say that again. You are so overwhelmingly loved by God. He has deposited his eternal spiritual love in you, and it's so overwhelming and so overflowing that you don't have to take it or manipulate it to get it from someone else. And also, there's such intense overflow that there's enough to give to people who don't even deserve it. There's enough to give to people who are unlovely. There's enough to give to the person who's in your office who is perpetually annoying. And I don't mean surface annoying. I mean right to your bones, like fingernails on a chalkboard. And they may not be in your office. They may be in your home. God has given us so much of his own love that it is overflowing, and he gave it to people like us who didn't deserve it and who would never return it to him if not for the work of his spirit to cause that to happen. And this new heart that we have, this reborn, rebirth into the new family, has a reputation. You have joined a family that has a reputation. God is the Father. His essence, his actual being is defined as love. His Son, who he himself has demonstrated his love for us, the reputation of the family is on the line, and when you join the family, you became a part of a reputation of God's family to be a people who love. So how exactly has God changed you? What exactly happened? And in our difference, in the fact that God has made us different, you've got this in your notes. Number three, we are different in that there's a different way we treat each other, and that is with wholehearted love. We treat each other different. Well, how do we treat each other? Are we kinder, gentler, more polite? I'd say it's more than that. It's wholehearted love. Even Mr. Rogers knew this to be true. Anybody see the documentary? I heard people were crying. I heard standing ovations at the end. It made me love Mr. Rogers even more than I've ever loved, which I didn't think was possible. I didn't love the puppets, though. Those are a little creepy, you know what I mean? Mr. Rogers said the greatest thing that we can do on the planet during our lives is to help somebody know that they're loved and that they're capable of loving. He got it. Figured it out. The greatest thing. So, number one, different love is unique. Here's how it's unique. It is genuine, not deceitful. There is a genuineness to the love of a believer who belongs to God that is different from the deceitful love of other people. And by different, I mean unique. It's radiant. It reflects well on the reputation of God. So now, if you belong to Jesus, there's a transformation in the way that you treat people. Actually, your love that you demonstrate to one another is sincere love. It's not fake, phony, or otherwise projected onto somebody. It is real. It is genuine. It's the real thing. Paul writes in Romans that that in order to love with sincerity, it has to be more than pretending. He says, really love people. He says, express your heart's affection to one another. Express it. Don't wait until they pass away and you've got to write a eulogy and then say everything that you love about the person and they're not able to actually perceive any of it because they've passed on somewhere else. That while you're alive, Paul says, express heartfelt affection to the people in your life. And Paul also says in Romans 12, enjoy honoring each other. Listen to this, enjoy it. Enjoy honoring one another. How many of you don't mind so much when somebody honors you? Be honest. You don't mind so much when they honor you. Would you raise your hand? Where are you? You don't mind so much getting honored a little bit, right? Enjoyable? Imagine this. Here's what Paul says. Paul says in Romans 12, when you belong to God, you delight even more in honoring somebody else. You enjoy, you're thrilled by elevating somebody else in the view and opinion of other people. Sincerely love each other. Be marked. Believers are marked by a sincere brotherly love. Now, is there really a thing as insincere love? When you think about this, insincere love, it sounds like it doesn't, how does that fit together? Because if it's love, it's not insincere, right? But what the authors here in the letters to the church are saying is there's a way in which that we can kind of appear to be loving, but we're really not. It's a little bit deceitful. And sometimes it's deceitful unknowingly. In other words, we don't really have the agenda or the purpose of trying to deceive somebody, but we don't really actually, we're not aware of what's generating our expression of love. And what Peter says here is that we have to love sincerely without hypocrisy. It's genuine, not faked. And here's how it would be defined. Our love isn't an attempt to get something from somebody. That the love that we're expressing is so genuine and so sincere that we don't expect anything in return. So we love somebody even if they don't behave the way we want them to. Sincere love means that we don't love because we get a little kickback. I'm not loving somebody because I will somehow, by connecting myself and winning their approval, I won't enhance my status or my own reputation. That my love is extended, my affection is devoted, and I give it to somebody no matter what return I receive. Now, you could probably test a level of insincerity with a simple question, and that is this. Have I noticed in any way, shape, or form that the return on my love is diminishing, and therefore my affection is also diminishing? In other words, is my affection fading because I recognize that the return on this love is also fading? Another way to kind of test for sincerity is to consider, is it possible that this person that I'm supposed to be loving, is it possible that I treat them one way to their face and then I treat them a different way when they're not in my presence? It's a sure sign of insincere love. In the scriptures in the New Testament, one of the definitions or one of the marks, characteristics of insincere love is unkind speech. Unkind speech. And there's three forms I wanted to mention to you: gossip, backbiting, and slander. There's no quicker way to undermine and sabotage your own love for somebody than to engage in gossip, backbiting, and slander. Gossip, of course, being taking someone else's business and passing it along to another person. It's their business, and I take that business as if it's my business and then pass it along to someone else. Then there's backbiting. Backbiting can be defined simply or generally as criticizing someone's character, motives, or choices behind their back. I had a pastor friend who was describing how things were getting really, really bad at his church, and he said, listen, here, let me explain how bad it's getting. The same people who kiss me on the cheek on Sunday, I realize now, are biting me in the back on Monday. And he was using that to demonstrate that there's a lot of insincere love that is being expressed in order to enhance one's reputation or to otherwise not let on. And then, of course, we have slander, which is accusing or condemning someone of evil intent. slandering somebody means that I am judging, accusing, or condemning them that their intent was evil. Slandering somebody. So all of those things, you see all those things as unkind speech undermine someone's ability to express sincere love. And when we love with sincere love, we have a pure heart, and the motive is not to get something from somebody, it's to give something to somebody. I am loving you as a contribution. You know when we learn this? When we have newborn babies. When we have newborn babies, there is only one-way love going on. Am I right? Maybe some of you could probably convince me otherwise, but for the most part, I remember thinking this is just a one-way thing. All give, no receive, right? In fact, some of it was like all take, no receive. And we learn this at a very early stage in raising kids, that our real love is tested when we get nothing in return, but it was so rewarding, and my love was in question when I started to realize I really love this child because I'm getting a little response back. Or I should say, it certainly made it more rewarding and easier to love. But sincere love says, my motive is to give something to you, not get something from you. So to love sincerely, the people that we love, we understand that they have dignity. The people that we love, we understand that by virtue of having been created in God's image, that even that we ourselves deserve nothing but God's anger at our sin. But the foundation for which we love other people is knowing that God has created them, they belong to him, and they have inherent value and worth, not because they're in our political party, not because we agree with everything they say and do, not because we like them, or not because somehow we get something from them, but we love them because they belong to God who created them and made them with worth, and they were created in his image, in his likeness. And sincere love is, I love you because who you belong to the Father in heaven who made you. And that generates a sincerity in our love that is unique to people who belong to God. The dignity, by virtue of having been created as God's image, generates enough for us to love people with sincerity. Number two, different love is unique. Here's how it's unique. It's a willing, not a feeling. This different kind of sincere, wholehearted love is a willing, not a feeling, okay? So make sure you have the word willing in quotes, because if you don't, it doesn't work out in the English language. It's a willing. Show willing love. Verse 22 describes this. Love each other deeply. I want to say that what that means is wholeheartedly. And here's a definition of love that I think is easy for us to miss, but here there's a lot to this, but are you willing to kind of think about this, kind of turn your brain on for a second? Check this out. The definition of love, this is it. Treasuring or valuing of another person that is rooted in and flows out of a true knowledge of who they are. It results, there's action, in righteous or appropriate actions toward them. In other words, the more I know them, the more I value them. The more I know about them, whether perceived or real, the more I treasure them. And it's followed up with appropriate action of esteem and affection. That's the definition according to one commentator, that treasuring or valuing is an inclination of the mind toward somebody. An inclination of the mind. It is based on what I know about somebody or what I think. And this kind of reminds me of what happens when I think about the way in which my wife sacrifices and serves her family for the benefit of themselves. And as I incline my mind towards that kind of selflessness and service, my esteem, affection, and devotion increases. My sincere love. Some of you have a child or a parent or a sibling who has been battling a life-threatening illness, disease, or is walking through a period of devastating grief. And as you watch their courage emerge from them, you incline your mind to them, your affection increases. Why? Because you value them and treasure them even more for who they are. You're getting nothing from them, but you're inclining your mind towards them as you watch and see the courage or the joy or the strength or the character that is being demonstrated, and you instinctively appreciate them with an increased affection. When we are inclined towards someone for who we have appreciation, our affections go up. We value or treasure them and treat them different. It is very similar to the way that we treat our new car when we drive into a parking lot and park where? Way, way out. We find a very, very private space, and we do so because we cherish this vehicle and we don't want anything bad to happen to it. But over time, it gets old and worn out and gets a little beat up, and before we know it, we're wedging it between two dump trucks so that we can get a spot close to the door. Why is that? Because our appreciation for this thing diminishes over time as it gets older and older. And what this is describing is an appreciation that always looks at other people as having utmost value so that we don't want anything bad to happen to them. And in our minds, we're always inclining them towards that extra parking spot where nobody can do any damage to it because they in our minds have value. We treasure them. We value them. When we feel like they've been dinged up or scraped or scratched, we step back and we walk around the person and say, are you kidding me? What just happened? And around, we've done this to our cars, haven't we? What are they thinking? I swear every car I own, I don't know how or why, it doesn't matter where I park, people's doors find my car. You ever notice, is it just me or is it you too? And I have to remind myself, because this is just a thing, I should have the same approach to people that I value, that I'm willing. When I think that somebody is being damaged or dinged, who I care about, I walk around and say, what happened? What's wrong? How can I help? The Western world that we live in says this, that our love comes from the word erotica. It is simply a feeling. It's generated in your body. I remember it when I was in high school, junior high school, when eventually one of our friends in our friendship group, one of the guys would kind of confess secretly that I kind of have feelings for her. That's what he would say, I have feelings for her, I will admit it. And by that, he meant to say, I kind of love her. I have feelings for her. How many of you would admit that the people you love the most, you sometimes have really strong feelings, but they're not always good feelings? Feelings in the Western culture cannot, should not, especially as believers, will ever define what love is. I have feelings for someone does not define love. We love people, and it's not a feeling, it's an act of the will. It's deeply, it's with all your heart. In fact, John writes this way, do not merely say that we love each other, let it show us by our actions. So love is a willingness, it's a will of our mind and our soul and our spirit. It is an activity of engaging ourselves in our whole mind, heart, mind, soul, and strength. Love involves the whole person. My will, my mind, also my affections. Peter, in describing love here, uses two different words. He uses the word Philadelphia or the word phileo, which means brotherly and sisterly love. It's family love. It's a love for a lifetime. It is it's a cherishing of one another. And then he uses another word called agape love, which is a love that's unconditional. It's a love that is sacrificial. It's a love that's overflowing, and it's God-like. It's the same kind of love that God used to love us when we don't deserve it. That's the kind of love we share with each other. And this kind of love is generated by the Spirit. It's not generated by our own goodwill. There is a constant power of the Spirit, not something that turns on and off. But as believers, we don't feel it once in a while. We will it because the Spirit is always in us willing to love. And it's miraculous. We don't have to manufacture it. When you think about this wholehearted, fervent love, Peter actually uses a word here that means athlete. And when you express this love like an athlete, here's what he means. The same way an Olympian would take all their skills and talents and work and strive every day to perfect their performance, is the same way that Christians who belong to God love deeply, wholeheartedly, willingly. What that means is we take everything that God has given us, all of our skills, talents, and the work of God in us, and we diligently work every day at improving our conduct or performance. Same picture, same idea. That In fact, since Christian love is not a feeling, it's a matter of the will, we show love to others when we will to treat them the same way that God treated us. God forgives us, so we will to forgive others. God is kind to us, so we will ourselves to be kind to others. Willing is something we must constantly work at if we are going to succeed. Here's why we don't succeed. There's probably a lot of reasons. Here's one reason. Because sometimes our love has a little poison in it. And it's supposed to be a power love, but sometimes there's a poison love. And what I mean by poison love is that it's got this strand or this residue of pride in it. And when our love is poisoned by pride, we find ourselves loving primarily by our preferences. What does that mean? That means that I believe that my way is good and your way is bad. And if my way is good and your way is bad, then it's okay for me to not love you because you're not doing it the right way. Also, love can be driven by pride in our prejudices. My people are good. Your people aren't as good. I love my people more than I love your people. Or, I love my people, that's why I don't love your people. How about this one? The prejudice of someone else's sin is bad, my sin gets a pass. My sin gets a pass, but your sin, probably on the edge, doesn't really deserve the same merciful treatment that I get. Then we've got the politics poison in our love, and that simply means this, that I find myself loving people and caring for people who agree with me. If you agree with me, I'll give you my affection, I will esteem you, I will value you, I will treasure you, I will incline my will towards you, I'll express love to you, but only if I discover that you agree with me. When I discover you don't agree with me, then I separate you, I reduce you, I lower you down, you don't get my favoritism or my affection because we don't agree. That, of course, is generated out of the desire, or the hope, I should say, that is resting in government policies and politicians. Politics love is also this. It's my affection is expressed to people who benefit me, and it's not expressed to people who can't benefit me. And all of those things will poison our love. But we're supposed to have a different kind of love. That's a power love. And the power in our love is this, that when we love adequately, the way that God has described, wholeheartedly, willfully, sincerely, the power in our love, according to Jesus, is that there are outsiders who will discover and will believe there's real evidence that you belong to me, that you belong to me based on how well you love each other. Jesus said your love for one another will prove to the world. What proves that we belong to Jesus is not, as important as it is, our high moral standards or our devotion and faithfulness or our perceived zeal and passion for the proper policies and right behaviors. According to Jesus, people know that you belong to Jesus based on our love for one another. If there is no love, you can come to the conclusion that they are not a believer, that they don't belong. It is proof that someone isn't a real believer. And Jesus loved the church, and since he loved the church, so will we. And if you have a question, I mean, I think it's reasonable to say, with all of this that I see around me, Pastor, how do I know that God loves me? How do I know that Jesus was a loving person who, here's how we know, that the scriptures teach us this, that in that very same time, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He didn't wait for us to get cleaned up. He didn't wait for us to become lovable. He didn't wait for us to say and do the right things. He didn't wait for us to join a church and sign up for Sunday school classes and buy the biggest Bible we could find. He didn't wait for us to tell our neighbors all about him. While we were still sinners, dead in our sin, hostile towards God, separated by a wall of hostility, while we were still his enemies, he emptied himself, did not consider equality with God something to be clung onto. He wrapped himself in the flesh of a human being, and he subjected himself to sin and death and the grave so that he could demonstrate, I love you. And I'm getting nothing from you this is all for you. And this is the kind of love that is now in us, has come alive. The same Spirit that raised Christ from the dead, guess what? It dwells within us. It is at our disposal to expend. To spend this kind of love is to do what Jesus did. How does Jesus express his willing love? He does it with everything he had, laying down his life to say, I'm willing this love to you. And this is surely a test among the unbelieving world. It's a test as to our genuineness. So here's what I've noticed, that you and I, as believers in God's church, we thrive in relationships with one another. I wonder if some you can remember a period of time in your life where you were a little bit afraid or closed off, playing it safe with people, and found yourself isolated. I would suggest to you that every minute that you spend isolated from God's people, you're on the drift away from the life of God in you. And it takes some courage, doesn't it, to say, I'm going to open my life, I'm going to move in, incline my will to be giving and loving and affectionate towards other people, even though it might cost me like I'm in a family. And I might get stung by someone in my family, but I'm stuck in the family. It's going to be a lifelong thing. And I want to invite you, church family, would you open your heart to new, deeper, more loving relationship with one another? Would you be sensitive to the conviction of the Spirit saying, you're undermining your love with your unkind words? You're underlining your love with pride and politics and preferences. Would you be open to the conviction of the Spirit that would say, you have all of the love that comes from heaven that is divine and powerful, unconditional, beautiful, and life-changing. I've given all of that to you, and it's in you for you to demonstrate with affection to those people that I've put in your life. Would you lean into that? Could we be a church that's thriving in relationships in smaller groups and that's open to what it takes to be a person who gives without expecting anything in return? And you can say it. And you can serve it, and you can use your time, talent, and treasure to grow it. The everyday stuff of life, getting involved with people's lives, inviting them to lunch, on Sundays, taking this time together to say, I'm going to invite someone into my life because I want to spend time knowing someone else and making myself available to be known. Don't wait for someone to invite you to love them. You go and do it yourself. You can start yourself. I remember every year that we host these Home for Christmas that Pastor Yon told you about, these weekends where we kind of get together for desserts, and it's very simple, it's very easy, and it's just dessert. But when I think back of all the years we've hosted them, I have come to better understand who people are and what they're facing. And my treasuring and valuing and esteem for them goes up. We've talked and met and learned and listened to people at my own kitchen table who are battling addiction, who are agonizing through a disease, or battling through the heartache of a divorce. People at my table who are suffering through the heartache of a prodigal child that's far from God. And every minute that we get a chance to get to know them through these conversations, I recognize that based on who they are and what they're battling, my affection for them goes up. It generates a better, more godly, Christ-like, believer, child of God kind of love. Any opportunity you get, I just mentioned one, this Home for Christmas, but we have Bible study groups and other ways in which you can get involved in a small group and start leaning into these opportunities that we have to express genuine and wholehearted love, where we can value and treasure somebody because we're learning more about who they are and what they're facing in their life. And be careful about how easy it is to wither when we are so quick and apt to abandon a church family because of some strong opinion that you have or some strong offense that you've taken. Be careful that you're not skimming the surface, making yourself unavailable for this kind of love. You need it. God's given it to you to demonstrate someone else needs it. Let's pray. Father, thank you.